Hello and welcome to Rangers Rundown, your 2018 podcast home for existential dread and interminable suffering. My name is Max and I'm joined today by Mike.
Hey guys.
Hayden is too busy crying and has barricaded himself in his apartment, although he is running dangerously low on ice cream and liquor, so we're expecting to see him again on Sunday once he has returned to the land of the living. So, big news of the week, Adrian Beltre strained his hamstring. Game on Tuesday. Did it on what should have been a probably double into the gap. Pulled up going into first. I know there were some questions on the internet that he may have injured himself on a somewhat playful scamper from first to third on a botched throw from the catcher back to the pitcher a couple of innings before then. However it happened, pretty depressing to see. Does feel sort of like this happens every year. We inevitably lose Adrian to some sort of hamstring gremlin, but really hurts to get it this early in the season and to get it while we're currently still missing Elvis and Rougned. Do you have any coping mechanisms, Mike? What's your go-to here?
Lots of alcohol.
I'll drink to that, I suppose.
It's focusing more on the prospects. That's all you can do at this point. The good news is it was a grade one strain, so prognosis is that he'll probably be out 3 to 4 weeks, which is a blessing. Could have been much worse.
As soon as I saw it, I was just hoping, just in that prank, please be a grade one. Please just be a little tweak. You know, he didn't tear anything, didn't mess it up real bad. So nice to see us maybe get lucky on that one and come in on the right end. We have had some decent injury luck, which sounds like a really weird thing to say considering how snake-bitten we are so far this year, but Delino came back from his hammock bone break pretty quickly, and Elvis's Olekranon injury has the shortest timeline for recovery I've seen on a similar kind of injury, so that's really nice, and hopefully that sort of quick recovery goes with us, because apparently we are going to be shuffling through injured players this year. We've got just all kinds of issues. One of those guys coming back, Doug Fister, managed to come back off of his relatively short hip issue, which is nice. We need to see a little bit more stability in the rotation. You know, he had a terribly mediocre, but it wasn't a terrible turn against Oakland. Big dinger to Chris Davis, which, sure, you know, it's going to happen. But I thought the interesting thing with the Beltre injury was our first lineup afterwards. So Joey Gallo coming up has been the third baseman of the future for many years now and played left field. And we put Isaiah Kiner-Falefa at third, which I think is notable because he's, in my opinion, he was the third baseman on the roster after Beltre, with Gallo and then Renato Nunez probably coming in ahead of him. Got any thoughts there? Any ideas why we might have put IKF in?
I think they just want to see if he can continue to handle himself at the plate. You know, obviously, he's a utility guy, so they're going to use him anywhere and everywhere that they need to. But he's been doing quite well. He's tied for the team lead in both RBIs and runs over the last week. So his promotion to the show hasn't correlated with the drop off in production from the minor league level. So I've been very pleased with what I've seen from him so far.
I think my favorite part about his approach has been just how cool he is. Dude is just cool as a cucumber out there. Nothing seems to faze him. He's been playing steady defense. He's actually getting hits with runners in scoring position, which I wasn't aware we were allowed to still do that. So that's been kind of fun to see. He's come through big for us a couple of times. I mean, he's definitely not been all sunshine and roses. Yeah, not a lot of power outside of that first home run. And we're not really expecting that to show up at some point. He does strike out, you know, a decent amount, and he's not taking a ton of walks. But all in all, I think it's been a pretty satisfying debut for him, and he's definitely somebody fun to root for. I was talking to Hayden before we got to recording it, and he did have a comment on putting Kiner-Falefa at third over Nunez, just to maybe see what he can do over there defensively. You know, we've got some opportunity to run guys through and want to see exactly what we got, and he might be somebody that we're balancing when it comes to who stays on this roster when Odor comes back, and then maybe even when Elvis does. I imagine he gets optioned down because we cannot option Nunez, but we may have wanted to give him a fair shake to earn the position over Nunez, as opposed to just by default go down because he's got options and Nunez doesn't. So something to look at, I think.
Kind of a crazy thought, but and I know it will never happen, but I would love to see them keep him up with the big league club and just make him the backup catcher, because he can catch after all. But
I really want to see him catch. I really want to see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the freak show this year, so let's go full on.
And I want to see him play 9 positions in a game. I think Austin Romine was maybe the last person who did that, but it's just fun to watch. And I don't think he's ever pitched. I don't think he's ever been a position player pitcher, and I don't think he could really play center field. But I mean, if Drew Robinson can play center field for this team, we can let Kiner Falefa eat an inning out there. What's the worst that could happen?
Who said that Drew Robinson can play center field?
Some guy. Like, this some dude walked out to me when I was doing my yard work, and he's like, "Hey, Drew Robinson's a center fielder." And I was like, "Okay, sure. That's interesting information you have there, random stranger." So we'll have to see what they do with Gallo going forward. I think the idea I've had in my head for the last couple of years is that whenever Adrian does decide he's done, either with his entire career or at least the segment of it that takes place in Texas, that we would just slide Joey over there and let him play. But maybe they're just trying to keep it simple for him right now. They already told him they wanted him just to play first, and then that got torpedoed, and he has to play left field, which I actually think he's been very good in left field. It does make me wish that maybe we were letting him play right and maybe having somebody else play first base. He made a great play at the wall yesterday using all of that 6'5" frame, and then got to show off the arm. Did you see that throw he had to first base?
I did.
I wish they'd showed a better replay of it, because I don't know how many skips it took to get to Guzman, and it did take him off the bag and everything, but that's about as long a throw as you can make on the diamond, the left field corner to first base, and he looked like he was having fun.
Both he and DeShields had nice throws last night. DeShields nailing the runner at third. That was a thing of beauty. It was, one hop.
It was a good throw. Got it right out. I think it was Semien, who is not a particularly fleet runner, but he's not slow.
Right.
So that was definitely gratifying. See, it's been nice having an actual center fielder the last couple of games. You know, DeShields' bat hasn't been on fire. I think he went 3-for-12 in the series against Oakland, 4 strikeouts to just the 1 walk. But he did have 2 steals. He did have a caught stealing, full disclosure. But he had 2 steals, and he's playing defense, and he's kind of doing the things you want Delino Shields to be doing. Hopefully that bat warms up a little bit as he gets used to playing with the Hammett problem, and he gets more in the swing of things, so to speak, at the top of the lineup.
I did see one funny note today after that game last night. Graveman took the loss, and did you see that the A's optioned him to the minors today?
I did.
It made me wonder, is this going to be a thing? Maybe this is something we can track. How many times a pitcher that loses to the Rangers just gets booted off the team the next day?
Yeah, it's that weird one where on the one hand you're like, yeah, our team was so good that we knocked a pitcher out. But then you have to remember, nah, our team is so bad that when a guy loses,
Yeah, I was envisioning a pitcher, he's just lost to the Rangers, he's sitting in his locker, manager comes up and says, well, this was going to happen, and hands him a bus ticket to Wichita or something like that.
We went over this. Jeff, we talked about this. You can't be losing to these guys. This is a moderately entertaining AA team. What are you doing? If you really liked AA pitching that much, well, have I got the news for you. So, yeah. Yeah. Sorry, Kendall. Sorry. We didn't really mean it. Another thing that stood out to me from the Oakland series, though, Joey Gallo at the plate went 4-for-10, two walks and only 1 strikeout in the series, which any series that ends with Joey Gallo playing all the games and striking out once is a good series.
Yeah, over the last week, he's only had 3 strikeouts. He's had 6 hits, 5 walks, got his first bunt in, which was nice to see him do against the shift.
Loved it.
His ops over the last week is 1.238. So,
yeah, anytime that number starts with a 1, followed by a decimal point,
you're good.
You want it followed by a decimal point.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely fun to see. Only 1 dinger over the last week, but those are going to come.
Of course. He's already got 7. He's on a 6-month season. He's already on pace for 42. It's going to be more than that, I think.
Yeah, I feel pretty good about Joey's ability to hit as many home runs as he feels like hitting. And it really did like seeing him drop that bunt. And it wasn't a particularly great bunt, and that's why I think people were so adamant that he try it. He didn't really get it as far up the line as you would have liked, although he got it away from the catcher, which I think is the most important thing to do other than it being fair at all. And it was a phenomenal play by Graveman to go and field that and actually make it a close play at first. So I think even an average pitcher fielding attempt there, and there's probably not a throw, or it maybe even sails into the seats and you're getting a second base out of it. So good to see him do that. You know, I think it was Tag was saying, if you're leading off an inning, you know, there's nobody on and there's nobody else, get yourself on base. And if the team is giving you first base, you know, go ahead and grab it. So that was really good to see that I was able to show that off to some older gentleman at the bar who was loudly complaining about people not bunting and get shifts. So Joey Gallo won entire Atlanta Braves organization 0. Ronald Acuna division. Oh boy.
He doesn't need to have finesse bunts. He just needs to get them to stop with the overshift. That's all that really needs to happen. We don't need to see Joey Gallo bunt 50 times a season.
No, but I want to see one Joey Gallo bunt double.
Yes.
I really want to see it. And it's going to happen. I can feel it in my bones.
Or even a bunt triple. Wouldn't that be something?
Ooh, ooh. Hey, Joey's sneaky fast. Like, he's actually pretty quick. Like,
he's just fast. Yeah,
he just moves. That dude motors.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that I think was a relatively well-kept Rangers fan secret last year. I think it always surprised people to see that Joey Gallo, you know, where he was on, say, sprint speed leaderboards and everything. He goes first to third. Is probably better than anybody anywhere near that size that I've seen. So just a phenomenal athlete. Definitely the highlight of the 2018 Rangers for me. Just love watching him play. And he's not the only guy who's flying around the bases. Ronald Guzman, all 12 feet of him and several tons. The guy looks like an ogre. He's running and, oh, that triple.
That was beautiful.
I thought he smoked it. I thought that thing was way gone off the bat.
Not just a triple, but a stand-up triple. I mean, wasn't even a throw.
No. And Kiner Falefa was hustling. I just think he didn't want to get too close. He was afraid of getting pulled into Guzman's gravitational field or something. He looked like he was running a man on fire. It was really good.
Yeah.
I'm definitely on board for weird triples. And if our 6'7" first baseman's going to put some balls in the corner and run to third, please. I signed up for this. I'd like more of it.
The only sad thing is it was the first triple in what, something like 47 games dating back to September. That's pretty depressing.
Yeah, well, not a triple happy team. We're very, very not 1980s.
No. Ruben Sierra incarnate is not present on this team.
Mm-hmm. So this is probably going to be a little bit more of an interesting question for the next time we run this segment. So I imagine that the season lead in triples record is not likely to fall anytime soon. But you were teasing to us that you did some work and pulled up some potentially unbreakable Texas Rangers records.
I did it that.
Give us the lowdown on that?
Absolutely. Before I get started, though, I do know the record for most triples in a season by a Ranger, and that would be Ruben Sierra. It was 1989 or so. He had 14, which is... That may be one of those unbreakable records, but yeah. So I like to do some deep dives and look at the stats, and with the way the team played this last week, I just thought, let's look backwards. Yeah. So I came up with 10 stats, and these are mostly from the pitching side. I may revisit the batting side later, but some stats that are going to be a surprise to some of our listeners. Just kind of some eye-popping numbers. So we'll start off at number 10, fewest relief appearances for the team over the course of a season. This record happened in 1978, as you would not be surprised. It's going to be an older team that would have done this, but the number really surprised me.
Yeah, weren't relief pitchers illegal in 1978? Wasn't that unconstitutional at the time?
They were like backup punters. They just didn't see a lot of action. So to put it in perspective, in 2017, the Rangers had 464 relief appearances, and right now, for 2018, they're on pace for 564, which some arms are going to fall off if we actually get to that number. But back in 1978, the number was 170, which is basically one relief appearance per game, and that's just mind-blowing to think about. And we know that it was a much different game back then. But, you know, when you have all the people complaining about how long baseball games are now, well, your answer is right there in front of you. You know, pitchers can't go as long, or they don't want pitchers to make the starting pitchers to make that third trip through the rotation, and so they're going to the specialty guys, and that eats up time. But I thought that was a pretty crazy number when I saw that.
Yeah, and relief pitchers are so good now. I think it used to be that relievers are basically kind of crappy pitchers. They're dudes who weren't very good at starting, even when maybe the bar to entry was a little bit lower. Whereas now there's so many of these like hyper specialist guys who are coming up as relievers and are working on their stuff simply as relievers, and they're so used to pitching out of the stretch exclusively or whatever it is they do. I think that definitely changes that calculus a little bit. So now not only do we just, does the game naturally tend towards relievers, they're really good. So you really want to keep using your good arms out of the pen. You know, teams don't have just, I remember a lot of Rangers teams that really only had one or two good relievers, period. And now we've got options that we can go to. And that's definitely going to extend those games out a lot.
You know, I'm a baseball purist. I hate it when they make changes to the game. But I would actually be in favor of going to maybe a 28-30-man roster where you could carry some more relievers so that you could see more of that specialization where you're not worried about wearing a guy out and causing injuries with these guys because they have to go back-to-back and get back out there. I would love to see that. If you're going to go specialty like that, specialized with the relief corps, then let's really let it flourish.
It'd be interesting to see if any teams start leaning even harder into the 10-day DL abuse. I know the Dodgers used that very effectively with their starters last year. I think it's going to be fun to watch if a team tries to stockpile optionable and useful like middle relief and late relief arms. I know the Rays have basically gone to that sort of bullpen day, although it looks like Yanni Chirinos is sort of the de facto fifth starter for that team. He is technically a reliever, but mostly he's just their fifth starter right now. And they have a lot of relief pitchers on that team. It'll be interesting to see if teams start leaning more into the 10-day DL and really starting to shuttle guys through with the options and just go even more towards the pen.
I think it will. It will happen, but I think we can rest assured that the Rangers aren't going to have, they're not going to be setting the new record for fewest relief appearances. Not in our lifetime. Maybe the game will change at some point down the road, but
pretty safe.
No. Yeah. So number 9 on the list, most complete games, and this was a cool one for me.
Individual or team?
This would be individual. Any guesses on the number?
So the Rangers, and these are just the Rangers, right?
Not
the
correct. Rangers. These are all just Ranger records.
Most complete games of the season, I would say 11.
This happened in 1974, and Fergie Jenkins was the one who set the record.
Not a surprising name.
No. 29.
Oh, man. Oh, no. Okay. That was only a little off.
That's unheard of. I mean,
how many starts did he have total?
It was around 40. I didn't mark that down. But yeah, Frankie Jenkins had 267 complete games in his career. That's just unbelievable. I know a little bit about the guy, but I would like to read up more about him and what his game was about, because that's so impressive that you're able to do that. I mean, these guys must just laugh at starting pitchers today, how weak they must be. So that leads into the number 8 record that I consider to be unbreakable, and it goes hand in hand, and it's the most wins. And again, it was Fergie Jenkins, and it happened in 74, that same year where he had 29 complete games. He had 25 wins. He was 20.
I was actually going to go a little higher, but I guess I may have been overestimating the 70s Rangers bats a little bit. Sorry, Fergie.
Well, yeah, 1974 is one of the worst teams they've ever had. So to win 25 games on a bad team just makes it even more impressive. He was 25-12 with a 2.82 ERA, 225 Ks. He had a WHIP of 1.008 and an ERA plus of 126. That guy was just a stud.
But I say that's actually good.
Maybe he gets our throwback actually good winner of the week.
And yeah, we'll start highlighting one old dude every week and being like, you know what? You know who was good? This guy that everyone knows was good. We're going to tell you about him again.
But yeah, I'd say that this is never going to be broken. You know, there's only been three 25-game winners since 1978. And the last one to do it was Bob Welch in 1990. Yeah. He won 27 games. And I just don't think it's ever going to happen again. Because your pitchers, they only get 30 starts now. So to get to 25 wins, you've got to figure you're going to have a few no decisions. I mean, you'd have to go like 25-1 or 25-2. And I just don't see it happening. I mean, maybe some Clayton Kershaw type is going to come down the pike someday and prove us wrong, but I just really don't see that record ever being broken.
That would be gobstopped if it did.
Yeah.
But maybe a reliever. We'll have who was it? Wasn't it Neil Kotz a couple years back? I remember this because I picked him up in my fantasy league because I just needed some strikeouts and he was having a great season. He wasn't even closing for us. But I picked him up in a fantasy league and he won, I think, four games in a week. Or maybe it was three games. But he won three or four games in a week as a middle reliever. And I won my week and got into the playoffs because of Neil Kotz, seventh inning man, racking up multiple mid-game wins in 1 week. So maybe that's our 25-game winner. We'll get an elite fireman reliever who comes in and saves our butts.
And has all the starters very angry at him for stealing all their victories because they didn't make it six innings.
I want a player who is the first true vulture, the vulturiest of all vultures.
Yeah. All right, so now we're up to number seven on the list. This would be most strikeouts. Unsurprisingly, it's Nolan Ryan. This also happened in 1989. 301, which I guess revisionist history, I always remember catching Nolan at the tail end of his career. Yes, he did have two no-hitters while he was with us, and he got the 5,000 strikeouts and all of the accolades. But to have 300 strikeouts, you know, it just less than 30 years ago, that's impressive to me because, you know, a 200-strikeout guy today, he's a stud. So now we're up to number six on the list, and this would be most consecutive scoreless innings by a pitcher. Want to take a stab at this one?
Oh, I think I did see something about this. Because we had somebody who threw well over, who threw like a perfect game over a couple of games and then went longer. It was like 33 or 34 innings for a relief pitcher just a couple years ago.
Now this would be all the way back to 1995, Kenny Rogers had 39 scoreless innings, and I remember this.
Yeah, okay.
That's 4.5 games without being scored upon. That's just, to me, yeah, Ranger pitchers proved me wrong, but I'd see they're going to have a hard time doing better than that because he was flirting with some major records when he was getting into that territory. I think Hershiser holds the record in Major League Baseball around 50, I think it was, but that was a pretty exciting time to watch Kenny. He was just pretty much unstoppable during that streak. So now we're up to number five on the list, and this one is one that I remember just the oddity of it happening was just, it was kind of mind-blowing. So most consecutive batters retired, and this would be by the team.
Ooh, okay, team most batters retire. So we do have the one perfect game.
Mm-hmm. But that had nothing to do with this one, so.
Oh, no!
It's a little more recent, just a couple of years more recent than that. So this happened in 1996, and Ken Hill was pitching against the Tigers, and he gave up a hit to the second batter of the game, and then he retired 26 in a row, and they won the game. So he had a one-hitter. It was beautiful. But what was even more surprising was he was followed by Roger Pavlik. Do you remember this guy?
Very dim.
I remember.
I was just looking at something that had Roger Pavlik on it, though.
He was just
in the last few minutes.
He was the good luck kid. He made the All-Star game, I think this might have been in 96. And one of the guys on the ticket on his local sports radio station said he would do his broadcast hanging upside down if Pavlik made the All-Star game. Because he did make the All-Star game. He had like 12 wins going into the All-Star break, but his ERA was like 5.5. It was awful.
He ended the year perfectly average. He had a 5.2 ERA, 101 ERA plus.
Yeah, but the day after Ken Hill pitched, Pavlik set down 14 straight, gave up a homer, and then retired the next 13 straight. So you had back-to-back one-hitters. That was really cool. In fact, the last... I couldn't find this on the American or in the National League. The last AL team with consecutive one hitters happened in 1917. So it's been 100 years since that's happened. Besides these guys, so it, like I said, it's a statistical oddity. But yeah. So the most consecutive batters retired. Of course. So yeah. So it was 40 in a row that they retired between the two of them.
Pretty good.
Not bad. So number four on the list. This is the one of the unbreakable records. It's the one I see most easily broken, but I don't see it happening at least anytime soon with our current rotation. Most consecutive wins by a pitcher.
In decisions or just without a loss in between?
Without a loss.
Okay. I'm going to go with 7.
The answer is 12.
Ooh, 12, okay.
Yeah, this happened back in 1990. This was Bobby Witt, and this is a stretch.
Yeah.
It's Bobby Witt, to me...
That's a name we should be keeping an eye on going forward as well. His son is a top prospect in the draft this year.
If we're going to go full-on team tank, that may be the number one pick in next year's draft. I would love to see them pick him up. But yeah, Bobby Witt, he went from June 28th to September 6th without losing a game. I mean, just think about that. That's Bobby Witt. It's like, I think Martin Perez is a Bobby Witt starter kit. Bobby Witt, he always had flashes of brilliance, but he always managed to disappoint. And it was always just that same thing where one inning he would melt down and get all frustrated with him. He had some good seasons with the Rangers. He was a very good pitcher. He's not a Hall of Famer by any stretch, but he was fun to watch back in the day. But yeah, 12 wins in a row. Rangers pitchers prove me wrong. So now we're on to number three, and this is a fun one. And again, I think this is one of these that could be broken, but it's been standing since 1991. This would be the most consecutive wins by the team.
Ooh.
So this isn't pitchers' victories. This is just team victories, just the longest winning streak.
Which, for the Rangers and most of their team history, is definitely an offensive stat, and that's why it's a lot more notable to see a pitching one.
Right.
To maybe discuss it as a pitching thing. So, consecutive wins by this team, I'm going to say 15 wins.
Ooh, very close. It was 14.
Ooh.
So this was a team that had, if you remember, on a prior podcast, I had talked about times when they'd gone with the youth movement. And this was in between. So in 86, they went with the youth movement, but it was before the youth was really in full swing when they made the playoffs in the late 90s. So you had a blend. So you had, on this team, you had Palmeiro, Sierra, Franco, and Gonzalez. So Sierra and Gonzalez, their overlap was very brief. It might have been one or two seasons. You had Pudge as a rookie. You had Steve Buscemi and Dean Palmer both seeing time at third base. That was the changing of the guard there. And just a lot of mashers on that team. But the most interesting thing about this is why they won 14 games in a row. And I remember hearing about this when it first happened. And it's funny. Beer is the great motivator, apparently, because Nolan Ryan went to Bobby. And me as well. Nolan Ryan went to Bobby Valentine and complained because Valentine would not allow beer in the clubhouse post game. And Valentine said to him, "Win 10 in a row and I'll allow beer back in the clubhouse." And what they do? They win 14. But
Roll Tide.
Exactly. But the funny thing is, just looking at the team slash line during that 14 game winning streak, this is for the team. 348 batting average, 420 on base, 542 slugging. So the team ops was 962.
Wait, so you're telling me that when beer was on the line, we on-based 420?
Yes. as a team.
That's awesome. You know, somebody came up in that last plate appearance, and they're like, "Do not screw this up, one way or the other. How, whatever this is, you need to nail this."
Yeah, like if you don't get this hit, you might as well just quit the team and walk away.
Let's see who it was who managed to do that. I'm gonna pull up that box score real quick. Give that play by play.
So I'll tell you, while you're looking that up, they outscored their opponents 114-57, so exactly 2-1 over 14 games. It's unbelievable. And I remember being a part of that, just every day reading about it in the paper, just going, good gosh, this team's never going to lose. Of course they did. They didn't make the playoffs. Of course they did. Because they got their beer.
All right, so that would be bottom of the eighth with... Let's see. We had a walk from Sierra, Julio Franco. It's a two-run home run. Gonzalez pops out. Stanley comes to the plate and strikes out swinging. And then with everything on the line, anything getting on base will mess it up. Steve Buschel comes through and strikes out to preserve the 420 opportunity.
Boo! There you go.
That's how it ends.
Yeah, you had to give Steve Buschel the boo there. That's awesome. All right, so we're... almost rounding up the top 10. We're at number 2 now. I would love your reaction to this one. Most consecutive relief appearances. So Bush, he gets sent down to the minors today after 4 straight appearances. Is that what he had?
It sounds like that, yeah.
So what's the record for the most consecutive relief appearances?
See, I want to say it's not going to be that big, but then... there could be some weird nonsense in here. So I can't be too high. So I'm going to go with 6.
The answer is 13.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
This was Dale Mahorchik in 1986. They called him the horse. That was his nickname because they just rode him.
Oh,
he
no.
He wasn't particularly good. He was a closer for one season. Then Jeff Russell came in the next year, and the horse was kind of his setup guy. But... they just ran him out there every night. It was insane.
That's so nuts. That is... I thought yeah. 6 is... I was hoping to find out it's like 5, you know.
Right.
13, dang, okay.
I'm pretty sure that one's going to be unbreakable. What do you think?
That's going to be really hard to mess with, yeah. I mean, the only guy who could potentially do that is Alex Claudio. And yeah, I don't think that
yeah,
right now.
Yeah, he could. At least. Or if you had a knuckleballer in the bullpen, I guess that could happen. Which leads me to number 1 on the list, and this one is a really unique, specific record, but I just wanted to talk about this one, so I kind of shoehorned it in there. And this
hey,
will be,
that's the Rangers rundown way.
Yes. So this will be most strikeouts in an inning in the All-Star game without finishing the inning.
Okay, so... It kind of has to be 3, right? That somebody advanced on one and they replaced somebody?
It is 3. Oh. And this was Charlie Huff in the 1986 All-Star Game. And, I mean, if you want to see just wildness, you should really go to YouTube. I looked it up and watched it yesterday. Just type in Huff 1986 ASG and it will pop up. And it's 12 minutes of gloriousness.
Oh, no.
The best part about it was the catcher, and this was late in the game. It was in the 8th inning. And so the catcher, he was the 3rd best catcher. They'd already run out 2 before him. It was a guy from the Red Sox. I didn't even recognize his name. He had never caught a knuckleballer before. And watching him trying to catch Huff's knuckleball is just hilarity because he has no idea where it's going. They're all getting by him. So Huff... his line, he had 2 hits, 3 strikeouts, only recorded 2 outs. There were 3 pass balls, but 2 of them the catcher was able to recover on. 2 runs, 1 earn, and throw in a balk. It has a little bit of everything. And I mean, his knuckleball is really dancing all over the place. I loved going back and watching it because it's a lost art, you know. The last guy was R.A. Dickey, and he was okay at it. I mean, obviously, he had his Cy Young season, but Huff, when he was on, it just it was silly just to watch the guys flailing at his pitches and just getting a great laugh out of him. So I would highly recommend going and looking that one up.
And the 1996 All-Star game did also feature pitching appearances from Roger Clemens, who had the start for the AL. Dwight Gooden started for the National League, which makes me a little sad. Fernando Valenzuela pitched in that game.
Tim Raines is one of the guys that Huff faced. You had a young Cal Ripken in there. I mean,
Tony Gwynn led off for the National League.
You see guys spanning different generations, some of the older guys and some of the younger guys from the next era. It's kind of cool to watch.
Oof, that is... I'm going to have to pull that video up. That sounds like a very good way to spend 12 minutes.
Well, if you want to spend more than 12, I would recommend there's a documentary that they did on HBO back in 2012 called Knuckleball. Have you ever seen that?
I have not, no.
So they bring in some of the greats from the last, I don't know, quarter of a century. No, more than that, 40 years, I guess. Tim Wakefield, Charlie Huff, R.A. Dickey, Phil Niekro, Hoyt Wilhelm, and just they just talk about the art of the knuckleball, and it's pretty fascinating to watch. I really wish some guy would come out and be a true knuckleballer. I don't see it happening, but I pray for it.
I know there was somebody coming up through the minors like a year or two ago who was supposedly going full knuckleball, but I'm blanking on who that is right now. Also in the camp of being a big knuckleball fan, I'd love to see another one come through and actually crack it and make it work. One of my favorite things that sort of modern baseball highlights has been able to do, there's a video where they colorized one of Dickey's knucklers, and so you see like just not only how crazy the movement is, because that thing is going everywhere, but how they don't spin at all. And when you highlight the different parts of the ball, so you can actually see that it's not spinning, that it's just wobbling all over the place. I don't know how anybody catches that. Like, you just close your eyes and hold the glove out and hope it hits it, I think.
Yeah.
This is how I caught when I played baseball, so.
Yeah, there was some quote from some catcher. He said, how do you catch a knuckleballer? You throw everything at it, you wait for it to stop rolling, you go over and pick it up. That's pretty much it.
Just kind of get in front of it. Okay, so that's a pretty good list of, I think, pretty conclusively unbreakable or amazing if broken records. So I'm now on tenterhooks for the next version of Rangers unbreakable potential hitting or team records. I'll have to look out for that in the future. And we'll be looking for that maybe in the coming weeks. Our upcoming series, so we have the Toronto Blue Jays. We're going to Toronto for this series, so I mean, you know, maybe Beltre did in fact go ahead and pop that hammy now, so he doesn't have to play around in Rogers Center. You said that earlier, Mike, and it's been sitting in my head, and it's not the worst strategy.
Well, no, I mean, better the hammy than his knees on that AstroTurf. That's
gonna get
awful.
Hurt.
So yeah,
might as well do this. This is simpler.
Yeah.
Probable pitchers there. We should see Marcus Stroman versus Mike Minor in Game 1. Jaime Garcia and Bartolo Colon on Saturday. And then Jay Happ, whose first name, it's the letters J-A. His actual name is J, and he goes by J-A, which is pronounced J. Or maybe his name is James. I don't really remember. It annoys me every time I read it. But Jay Happ, Martin Perez. I'm excited to see Mike Minor against a lineup that isn't Seattle or Houston. That should be fun. Stroman is a guy who at times has been a dominant force, and this year is not one of those times at all. He's been quite bad. So maybe that lineup can feast a little bit and support Mike and see if he can maybe go deep into a game.
Yeah, I think this would be a good series just to pretend this is the playoffs redone without Batista, without Encarnacion. You know, actually level playing field and see if we can actually win this series.
Jaime Garcia, Bartolo Colon should be fun simply because it's Bartolo Colon, and then one of the pitchers we declined to sign this year. And then Martin Perez, I'm really interested in seeing which version of Perez we get. So I'm working on another write-up that I'll hopefully have out and available for folks next week, going over a potential mechanical shift. Perez dramatically shifted where he is releasing the ball in his last start. He moved his release point in about 6 inches, which is enormous, and it puts it on the inside part of his career release point spray charts. He had been more or less at his league average, his career average, before this last start, and he pulled it in a lot and was much more effective. He finally got swinging strikes. He was by far the best on his sinker that he's been on this season. The changeup looked like it was kind of working. So maybe that's something that he was consciously doing, and it's going to be a thing going forward, something to look out for. We'll have our answer, I think, come Sunday evening.
Yes, I'm definitely not going to miss this game because I want to see if this is the new and improved Martin Perez.
I think we all would like to see that. I know his early season performance left really no room for that kind of optimism, but hey, this last start was encouraging, and we'll see what we get. But until then, I think that's going to do it for us here at Rangers Rundown. So hope you guys are still enjoying the show. We're having a lot of fun putting it together, even when we're messing up and leaving entertaining things for Hayden to edit out for us whenever he gets around to it. So hit us up on Twitter. We are at Rangers Rundown. Find us there. You can find our individual handles through there as well. For any feedback, you can also contact us by email at rangersrundown@gmail.com. So for this episode, I'm Max.
And I'm Mike.
And that's your Rangers Rundown. See you next time, folks.